Thank you very much for the invitation to speak. A couple quick announcements before I get into my presentation. The Animal Agriculture and Environment Business Meeting will be Wednesday, I believe at 3:05, over in the Hyatt Regency. So please look to, if you can, please attend. It's always good to have input from the members about upcoming symposia and ideas. Other announcement is I've asked a few folks to help out with judging for the poster sessions. We're going to have a break immediately after this session, and if you are one of those folks that agreed to judge posters, or by the kindness of your heart would like to judge posters now, please see me outside during the break, and I can get information and materials to judge the posters. So thank you very much for helping out with that. So typically, like Andy Cole, I'm one of those guys who's out there mucking around in the manure, and very infrequently I get a chance to go out and see where does that manure go. And my collaborators, mainly Virginia Jin, has a long-term study site that she's set up in Clay Center, Nebraska, with UNL collaborators, looking at various effects of carbon management in continuous corn production. And so one of the opportunities that we had was to look at carbon application through the application of manure to these systems and try and understand what are the impacts of that type of management. So with the help of a graduate student, Tyler, and another collaborator in Clay Center, Brian Woodbury, we've been looking at the site now for almost 3 years and going into fourth year, and hopefully we'll continue to generate some long-term data on this site. Of course, there's the field applications. There's benefits and costs of manure, and this is just a short list. I'm sure other folks could add things to this. But certainly, closing the loop on the nutrients and addition of organic matter to the soil, there's various positive aspects to bringing the manure back to the field. Of course, with that, we also have nutrient imbalance, potential for pathogens to be in the field, greenhouse gases, which we're going to speak about and see in this particular study, and then also pharmaceutically active compounds are one of these emerging issues that we need to understand and develop good practices to make sure that we get the best bang out of our buck for the manure. Some of the background issues with continuous corn production in our part of Nebraska and certainly other parts of the U.S., and we are looking more at continuous corn production crop after crop after crop. Certainly, you think of corn, there's the seed and the stalks can be used mainly as a food source, but now we're also going into biofuel sources. So there's a greater need to remove not only the seed, the grain, but also the stalks and the corn cobs and such to use in both as feed and as for cellulosic ethanol production. So some of these questions that come up is if we have this intensive carbon harvest going on, how does that affect the corn production yields? Other carbon inputs, can they make up for these intensive harvesting practices? And at this particular site, we're looking not only at manure, but we're looking at cover crops and variable rates of removing the stalks and the leftover materials. Finally, how are the greenhouse gases affected, and how does, say, reduced rainfall impact this? Certainly in an age of climate change and variable climates, we need to understand how multiple ecological factors will impact this environment and this production. So this long-term study, its overall goal was looking at no-till continuous corn, and there are two different irrigation rates we're looking at, a 60% and a 100%. I'm sure I could get you the specifics on what 60% and 100% looks like at this site, but I don't actually have that in the presentation. We could discuss that later. We're also looking at two fertilization rates and residue removal, either none or maximum. Maximum being going through and with a rake and actually collecting as much of it and baling the material up. Carbon amelioration, there's none a biennial cattle feedlot manure application. That's once every 2 years. And then an annual rye cover crop. So having this cattle feedlot manure application is kind of what got me interested, and hopefully what has drawn some interest here from the group. And it's kind of where I feel most comfortable talking about. So the study site is on Hastings silt loam, established in 2010, and it's had manure applications in 2010 and 2012. And this week, we're actually getting our 2014 application put on. 4 replicates per treatment. The methods that we use are static vented chambers using the ARS GraceNet protocol, 4 10-minute time points over 30 minutes, and then a number of soil and physical factors also to help help in the actual prediction of the correct fluxes from the system. Gas chromatography is used to measure the concentrations of the gas samples, and then we use a linear and quadratic models to fit the data. These long-term experiments, so we've been going at this now for 3 full field seasons, and Virginia Gin has actually got a poster on these long-term effects where we've gone out every 2 to 3 weeks and measured the gases in the field. I think it's some really interesting work and some interesting insights into what kind of microbial processes might be going on in the soils, that because we see some big differences in gas emissions at this site over the long term. Now, my presentation is going to be more on these short-term fluxes. After you have a manure application, what do you find? But in her, if you go to see her poster, if you can't see the poster, here's kind of the results in a nutshell. Basically, we found that CO2 is unaffected, but nitrous oxide is reduced, is stover is removed. We find an increase in atmospheric methane consumption at the lower irrigation rates. So I think that's kind of easily explained by having a more active aerobic community. There's also a considerable 3-year variability. So 1 year we can actually have some substantial emission, and then the next year we actually have maybe some evidence for consumption. But the overall 3-year trends are painting a very interesting picture, so I hope you can go visit her poster and see what those results are. So the short-term pulse experiment I'm going to talk to you about is what we did in 2012. We did these all on plots where residue was removed. Some plots, of course, that I saw have had no history of manure application. Some plots had and some plots have had manure application in 2010 and in 2012. We did apply roughly 10 tons per hectare, and we used paired chambers to look at the effect of if we have a fresh manure application versus manure that was applied 2 years ago, are we seeing some sort of lingering effect? Gases were measured on day 0, 1, 4, 5, 7, 15, so we're only looking at a short 2-week interval to look at this pulse of gases. Water was applied on day 4 using a hand sprayer to each of these chamber anchors so that we could control the amount of moisture there. And you can see from this picture, let's see, there we go. Here you can see clearly where the manure has been applied, and of course here we actually covered up this anchor to keep the manure from being applied in that particular plot, part of the plot, I should say. One other thing to point out, the manure, it varies year to year when you're applying manure. It can be very wet, it can be very dry, it kind of depends on what's been raining on the pile. And in this case, we were looking at a very dry manure that easily broken down, so we had a nice, even manure application. We know this year we do not have quite those conditions. We have very wet, chunky manure. So that, I think, will play out in the data that we collect over the next couple weeks, looking at, I think there's going to be some major differences in gas emissions, just based upon the original material. Okay, looking at daily emissions, these are the fluxes of CO2. The way this is laid out in the next 3 slides is you have low nitrogen treatment here, these 2 panels, and high nitrogen treatment on the right-hand 2 panels. upper row is the low irrigation treatment, and then the bottom row is the high irrigation treatment. And you can see here on day four is when we had an irrigation event. So for CO2, it's a pretty repeatable, understandable pattern. You know, on the initial day of manure application, day zero, you can see, I'm not getting my arrow here, there we go. You can see an increase when we have fresh manure applied in all treatments, we see an increase in CO2 emission. Then, of course, on day four and on subsequent days, we have emissions of CO2because we've wetted the material and the material is now undergoing biological activity and breaking down, so we have a CO2 pulse coming off. Looking at the methane, much more variable data, but take a look here. They're all on the same scales. You have zero being right in the middle of the graph. So below that line, we actually have atmospheric methane consumption. And above that zero line, of course, is methane production. Although it's very dirty, very, very messy kind of data, you can see, at least in the low nitrogen treatments, after irrigation, we actually get a bump in the methane consumption within the soil. Certainly under low irrigation, high N rates manure application, the new manure application, we're seeing atmospheric methane consumption. When we look at the high irrigation, high nitrogen treatments, we're seeing overall a production of methane from the system. And finally, the nitrous oxide, similar to the CO2, it's much more easier to understand and kind of interpret. You can see there's no difference on day zero or day one after the application of the manure, but once we wetted it, we immediately saw nitrous oxide coming off. Interesting thing is we see even a boost of nitrous oxide production in the chambers where no new manure was applied, but manure had been applied 2 years ago. So there might be some interesting kind of lingering effect here where the manure and the organic matter in that particular instance, rich in nitrogen, still is able to produce nitrous oxide. Okay, so carbon dioxide, we saw a transient increase in the flux on the day of manure application, much larger in the high moisture, high nitrogen treatment, which is interesting to ponder. Day four and five, larger pulses of CO2 due to irrigation, and then background flux levels by day 15. Methane, we see a decreased methane flux and increased methane consumption at the low nitrogen treatment and highest irrigation rates and N rate. The soil was a source of methane. Let's see if that comes back. Well, that's interesting. Okay, so nitrous oxide, there's an increased flux on the day of irrigation, larger for the manured plots, and the length of the pulse varied. I didn't point that out, but there were still some sites that had elevated nitrous oxide flux even 15 days after the moisture application. Looking at the total two-week emission is a nice way to compare these different treatments. There is some differences between N rates at the full irrigation rate. This is CO2, and you can see at the full irrigation rate, we had a much lower CO2 emission compared to the higher N rate. With methane, we can again see the at the lower moisture content, we're seeing methane consumption in the system. But at the high N rate, high moisture treatment, we have the methane production. Finally, nitrous oxide. We see enhanced nitrous oxide production with the new manure. But there is some legacy manure has an enhanced nitrous oxide emission, both at the high N rates and at the where we have 100% moisture and a low N rate. We see this increase in the legacy nitrous. So how do we kind of make sense of this data and go from here? I think for the CO2, manure had very little effect on overall CO2 emissions. We see higher fluxes on day zero, but I think that's kind of the old CO2 that was in the manure pile degassing as it goes out onto the field. An interesting thing to think about is when the manure is dry versus wet, are we going to see some differences between this? And I think we will. Cumulative emissions were lower at the 100% irrigation and the 125% N rate. It's a little difficult to interpret, but there might be something involved with nitrogen limitation, and maybe it was just more anaerobic, and so we had the physical process of the CO2 leaving the system was somewhat restrained. with a high methane flux variability between sites and days. It was difficult to interpret, but generally methane consumed at the low irrigation rates, and I think it certainly depends on the antecedent moisture in the soil and the manure. Nitrous oxide pulses, we see that during irrigation, and manure dramatically enhanced that flux. So immediately after manure production, if it gets wet, we're seeing nitrous oxide. I don't think that's a new story for anybody, but I think we're able to now kind of quantify that and make some comparisons and answer the big does it matter question. So pulling some of the data out of Virginia's poster and comparing it to the flux rates we see here, the two-week emission rates we see here versus the two-year emission rates we see there, we can see these emissions from these pulses are very low, but if you have a system where where it's constantly getting re-wetted, you could have these emissions being quite a proportion of the total emission. Something to think about. So the remaining questions was how repeatable we're getting the manure applied this week, and we'll kind of see that. Also, these additional irrigation events, do we see decreasing pulses over time? There's some work out there that shows, you know, you have a large initial pulse, and then you re-wet, and it's a little smaller, and then it's a little smaller. The fact that we see that legacy nitrous oxide still in the two-year application, I think we need to consider that when we're looking at these systems being some very serious sources of nitrous oxide. And finally, when we estimate these annual emission rates, should we estimate missed pulses due to irrigation? You know, we're biased. We go out and we measure when the weather's nice. We don't necessarily go out and measure when the weather is really bad and it's raining. And that may be when we're missing some of these pulses. So, thank you. Appreciate your attention. And if anybody has any quick questions, do we have time for one or two? Yes. Rick? I have that data, but I don't recall it off the top of my head. As I recall, you know, like when you apply moisture, you have the surface layer a few centimeters completely saturated, and then below that you have degrees of saturation. So of course, when we did this, we're sampling down 4 inches, and we're going to measure the overall average. So fairly saturated throughout that core. Wet. Slurry kind of material.
In scientific terms, it was kind of sloppy.
It was kind of sloppy. As I recall, the full moisture application rate was 1 inch of moisture, and of course 60% was, you know, 0.6 inch. So you can imagine what that does to a dry, you know, fairly dry field. So I can get the specifics to you later. Yes, Mark.
Yeah, Dan. So you started in 2010.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then you started removing the Stover?
Yes, in 2010.
Okay, so you obviously changed the soil carbon dynamics quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I found that in my sorghum experiment. See, as soon as I started removing the Stover, the CO2 fluxes just went. Well, we started oxidizing our...
Really?
Soil carbon. So how do you differentiate between what's going on from you changing the cropping system
to the actual manure applications?
Yeah.
That is a tricky bit to pull apart. And
yeah,
I think, and I,
plots.
What's that?
Yeah,
we have control plots. And so, for instance, the no manure plots were plots where we had, this was all on complete removal. So we're looking at relative effects at this point over that complete removal. There are control plots with no manure standard, and of course there's the various levels of nitrogen within that. So everything is controlled in the initial experimental setup, and I'm only presenting a small fraction of that particular experiment where we're removing all the biomass.
So do you have plots also measuring where you're returning all the biomass?
Yes, where there's no biomass removed at all. I think there's even plots, and we haven't been measuring them, where we're adding manure on top of that biomass. So it's, but for those studies, we're looking mostly at at soil dynamics, carbon dynamics. So, and that's really Virginia's kind of purview of the project. So, yeah. I believe it did. So we did do a nutrient analysis on that, on the manure, and just kind of the 10-ton rate was based, I think, on how much nitrogen would be liberated during that first year, and then so there was less nitrogen applied in that first year to those plots. Now, if I'm completely wrong about that, I'm sure Virginia will correct me on that, but that was my understanding of the experimental setup. Yes?
I apologize if I missed this. I'm wondering, you talk about a legacy effect. Did you look at like the soil nitrogen or like where the nitrogen was going outside of the retention?
There is that data. I don't have that in the presentation, but there's been a soil corings and even deep soil profiles have been taken at the site. I think they're doing it regularly, the deep profiles every 2 years, but the regular soil samples are being collected yearly. So that information is out there. I think we're going to get a lot of interesting insights into the process as we go 2 more years down the line, 4 more years down the line. You know, like you were saying earlier, Mark, we're not at equilibrium yet. You know, we're still kind of dealing with what's happened in the past. And even insights from this study where we look at that legacy nitrous oxide production, that was surprising to me, and I think it really hits that point home. Yep. Thanks, everybody.